Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
Chapter 3. The five officers, two state troopers, Deidre, and the two BCA members walk side by side across the bridge, their heads bowed, eyes scanning the ground for anything out of context. Their first sweep revealed nothing, so they turned and reversed their direction, this time moving closer to the side of the bridge over which the victim had been hurled. "Here, I just spotted something metallic when the wind kicked up a flurry of snow," Deidre shouted. She stooped and gently brushed away the powder with her gloved hand, picked up a brass object, and held it so the afternoon light shone on it. "It's a key," she excitedly announced to the group, "and there are letters stamped onto the top." She turned the key to catch the waning afternoon sun. "RRR. Do you suppose that stands for some railroad line?" She turned the key over in her hand, and the others came closer so they could get a better view. "It doesn't look like it's been used for quite some time," Cliff offered his opinion. Melissa contradicted. "Look closer. See those fine scratches in the patina? It's an old key that wasn't used for a long time, but I think someone has recently fit it into a lock, although not often." Cliff bent so he could look closely at the key. "You know, you're right. It's really tarnished, but up close, there are scratches on the side, and you can see that the teeth are a little shiny. But I don't recognize those letters. Nothing around here would have those initials. The only old railroad was the DM&IR. Reserve Mining had their own line, and so did the docks at Taconite Harbor further up the shore. They were built in the 50s, but the initials don't jive. Do you suppose those are someone's initials?" "Could be," Judy said. "But whatever it is, it's about the only significant clue we have. Why don't you bag it, Deidre, and lock it in your car?" As she bent over with her head in her patrol car, Lake County Search and Rescue pulled up, and her friend Scott got out. "Hi, Deidre. Thought you'd decided to retire." "So did I. Just filling in until their officer recovers from rotator cuff surgery. You probably know him. Dan Butler?"
"Oh, sure, Dan. I know him well. He's a good man," Scott added.
"So now you've got yourself up to your neck in another tough one. What's the story? I don't see anything." He looked around to see what he missed. "Under the bridge, but I'm warning you, it isn't pretty. Be prepared." Scott and two other members of the rescue squad followed Deidre down the bank, with Judy and Melissa close behind. The six of them gathered under the bridge, and Deidre shined her flashlight under the abutment. "She's up there, but I don't think it's going to be easy. She's curled in a ball and frozen solid. Maybe the best way is for two of you to lift her and the third keep her from rolling down the bank into the river. You might as well leave the stretcher here. It'll only get in the way. You'll see what I mean when you get up there." The men nodded. "Go ahead of me. I'll hold the light so you can see." The three search and rescue members began the climb with Deidre behind, as she had said. "Oh, shoot," Scott muttered. Deidre couldn't make out what the other two said. "What's wrong with people? She's just a little girl, probably as old as my seventh grade daughter." Then he stood, looking, shaking his head. Finally, he came out of his trance. "Okay, guys, let's get this over with." Together, the three burly men approached the body. They bent down to pick her up, one on each side and one on the downside of the bank. As they made their way down the steep grade and maneuvered past Deidre, she was stopped by the sight of tears freely flowing down their cheeks. In the direct light of day, Deidre could see that the girl's body was covered with bruises and scratches. Her back looked as though she had been flogged, and on the side of her face that was visible, Deidre saw a large welt under her eye. Everything was silent, the very sound of their footsteps muffled by the loose snow. They gently laid the girl's body on the stretcher and tried to devise a plan so she wouldn't roll off while it was raised to the roadway. While they were strategically placing straps around her, Melissa and Judy climbed to where the body had lain.
Deirdre could see them on their hands and knees, trying to find the smallest clue. By the time they finished, the search and rescue crew had worked their way to the top and had placed the stretcher into the back of their truck, which was equipped to serve as an ambulance. "Wait a second," Julie panted as she came up the riverbank. She bent over for a second to catch her breath. "Is there any way to keep the back of the vehicle cold so the body won't thaw? I'd like to be present while the process takes place." Scott looked at the others and shrugged. "Sure, we can do that. Bundle up, boys. It's going to be a cold ride to Two Harbors." Deirdre and Melissa watched as they pulled away from the scene with windows rolled down and the heat turned off. Judy was riding in the back, bundled against the cold, her hands thrust deep inside the pockets of her parka. "I think you can go now," Deirdre said to the highway patrol troopers. "Thanks so much for your help. I'm not sure how you do it, patrolling these lonely stretches of highway by yourselves. I'd be worried every time I made a stop that the driver was going to turn out to be somebody dangerous." "The nature of the beast," Kathy shrugged in resignation. They said goodbye and wished Deirdre luck with the investigation that they knew was not going to be simple. She looked at Melissa. "If you don't have a place to stay, why don't you come to my place for the night? I'm alone, except for my dog, and he doesn't bite. We can get up early and head into Two Harbors in the morning and find out how Judy's faring." Melissa called Judy on her phone to see if she needed help, and Judy assured her that nothing exciting was going to happen while the body thawed. She was going to stay at the mortuary that also served as the county morgue to keep an eye on the process, but she'd see them in the morning. "Let's stop and get something hot before we leave town. I'm about frozen to the core and could use some caffeine," Melissa said as she involuntarily shivered. "Do you have any good coffee shops in town?" Deirdre laughed as they walked toward their vehicles. "If you look on the internet for eating places in Silver Bay, you'll find only one listed, Northwoods Cafe. The info says it's a local coffee klatch hangout. We've missed their daily breakfast and lunch specials. When we get there, I'll fill you in on the town's history." In 5 minutes, they were at the shopping center, the only one in Silver Bay. As they entered the warm confines of the small shop, several patrons turned their heads to look at the two women coming in from the cold. George was there and appeared to be holding court at one of the tables, because all eyes were glued to him. When he looked up and saw Deirdre, his eyes widened, and he stopped in mid-sentence. "Deirdre, good to see you. Finish with whatever you were doing." His face flushed, and he averted meeting her gaze. "Well, boys, I better be getting home. My wife'll be wondering where I've been. I'm usually home by noon." "See you, guys, Deirdre." George nodded to her as he pulled a stocking cap low over his ears. Deirdre and Melissa chose a table in the far corner of the room, as far away from the rest of the customers as they could, although every time they looked up, they could see the patrons looking at them as if seeking clues about a mystery. Deirdre gave Melissa a brief history lesson of Silver Bay, how it hadn't even existed before 1954, how it was built by reserve mining for its workers, and how the company had dictated who could live where and what businesses could exist. She went on to explain how the community had boomed, reaching a peak population of nearly 4,000 in 1960, almost all of them young families with children. "I remember when their school was bigger than the one in Two Harbors, graduating 200 per class," Deirdre explained. "Then disaster hit when the company was charged with violating the River and Harbors Act of 1899. That's the oldest piece of federal environmental legislation on record in the U.S. It makes it illegal to dump waste of any kind into navigable water without a permit. I guess they didn't have the proper permits or something." They ordered when the waitress came by before Deirdre continued. "Anyway, a few years later, the taconite plant closed, and residents were forced to seek employment elsewhere. It did reopen under different management, but the workforce really dropped. Our population is pretty stable at around 1,800. Now too many of the residents are past childbearing age, so the school's taken a big hit. I think they have about 35 students per grade. It's sad." Melissa asked, "So that's why you agreed to fill in while Officer Butler's out? This is kind of a sleepy community, out of the way, and you thought not much could go wrong?" Deirdre smirked. "Yeah, that's why. Guess I was wrong, huh?" They had each drunk 2 cups of coffee and were warmed up. "Let's go," Deirdre suggested, and she and Melissa walked out the door, feeling the glances cast their way as they left. As Deirdre followed the driveway to her cabin, Melissa scrunched down in the seat so she could see the tops of the massive pine trees. The private road to Deirdre's place traced a serpentine path through the woods, following the route of least resistance. Bumping over the rutted dirt road for a half mile, Deirdre pulled up next to her rustic home. "Look at that view," Melissa exclaimed as she stepped out of the car and looked across Cedar Lake. It was partly frozen, and what ice had formed was covered with snow. Its pure whiteness intensified the lake's blue-black in the evening sunset. "This is perfect," she said, in awe of the setting. Just then, Deirdre's dog came bounding around the corner of the building, and Melissa stooped to ruffle his ears. "And I see you even have a roommate," she said, as she lavished attention upon him. "What's his name?" "That's Pete. I named him after a friend of mine who lives even further in the sticks than I do." She laughed, obviously happy to witness Melissa's approval of her living conditions. The two women entered the cabin with Pete leading the way. He headed straight for his dog dish and immediately set to crunching dry dog food, his tail wagging in delight that his master had returned home. Their breath hung in clouds of condensed vapor, and Melissa shivered. "Don't you have a furnace?" she wondered. "Oh, I've a small propane heater, but I don't use it unless I have to. I'll have a fire going in the wood stove in 2 minutes. It'll heat up quickly. I'd leave my jacket on until then if I were you." Deirdre balled up a few sheets of newspaper and crammed them into the stove before stacking a few pieces of kindling on top. She struck a match and lit the paper, which burst into flame. After adding a few sticks of flip maple, she closed the door and the stove came to life. Soon the red enamel of the Vermont casting heater turned a deep burgundy as it became hot, and Deirdre shed her coat. "Why don't you hang your jacket over here? In a few minutes it will be so warm you'll even want to shed your heavy sweater." Melissa looked at the logs that formed the walls of the structure, then looked overhead at the beams supporting the roof. "This is like something out of a Terry Redland painting. I can't believe it. I could stay here forever." Deirdre busied herself, deciding what to fix for supper. "It's beautiful, but I tell you, it gets old after a while. Lonely." She looked at Pete, who turned his head to stare at her. "Sorry, Pete, but sometimes you just don't fill the bill." Pete wagged his tail and came over to rub his head against Deirdre's leg. She reached down and patted his neck. "Well, enough of that. What would you like for supper? How does tube steak and sauerkraut sound?" She held up a ring of kielbasa sausage. "Sounds good to me," Melissa answered, "especially if you have some wine to go with it." "That I have," Deirdre reached under the counter and came up with an unopened bottle of Chardonnay. "This is a good one, my favorite." By the time the sausage and kraut were heated, the cabin was almost too warm inside, and Deirdre opened the kitchen window a couple of inches. It had become dark, and a full moon had risen over the lake. In the distance, a pack of timber wolves began their serenade. Melissa felt the hair stand up on the back of her neck. "No need to worry," Deirdre reassured her. "They won't come near humans. They're too smart to have anything to do with our species." She halfway meant what she said. After supper, the two friends sat on cushions in front of the glass doors of the stove. They were mesmerized by the yellow and blue flames of the burning maple, and Pete lay with his head resting on his paws. Every so often he would twitch in his sleep, then look up, trying to orient himself. "So how are you doing, Deirdre?" Melissa asked, concern in her voice. "Okay, I think. At least until this happened. I vowed I'd never put on another badge again." Melissa swirled the wine in her goblet. "That wasn't exactly what I was talking about," she pressured. "I mean, how are you coping since John's death? How are you surviving?" Deirdre watched the fire, and tears formed in her eyes. She shrugged. "I'm doing about as well as I can, I think. Most days I look forward to getting up in the morning, and I really am happy living up here. Do you remember Ben Van Gotten?" "Of course, he was the FBI agent who was a high school classmate of yours. What about him?" Deirdre cleared her throat. "Ben's wife died a little over a year ago. She was such a lovely woman and a terrific mother. Did you know that she and Ben had twin girls? They're 4 years old. Anyway, Ben told me that she was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer and died only months later." Melissa broke in. "What does this have to do with how you are holding up?" She calculated that Deirdre was trying to change the subject. "I volunteered to babysit the girls if Ben wanted to get away sometime, and he took me up on my offer. He went camping for a weekend, and I watched the little ones. I guess I fell in love with them the first day. Now, Ben and I try to get out and do something with them every Saturday. We take in a movie or sometimes go to a museum. They treat me almost as if I'm their mother." Deidre paused to let the emotion subside. Then she continued. Ben brought them up here a few times. We went fishing. A couple of times they've stayed overnight. And we built a bonfire and toasted marshmallows. They're so much fun. It's hard for me to leave them. And what about Ben? Melissa looked at Deidre expectantly. What about him? She answered a little too quickly. Oh, wait a minute. It's not what you think. We're just good friends. And his daughters need a female around to balance being with Ben all the time. She blushed and got up to pour another glass of wine. If you say so, Melissa said with a laugh, which made Deidre blush all the more. On a work-related note, are you all alone in this job? Deidre was glad the subject had changed. There's a part-time officer on weekends. He's quite a guy. Jerry looks like everyone's grandfather with his gray hair and mustache, but he's surprised more than one suspect. He's retired from the Minneapolis police force where he was lead detective with the drug unit. One time a young man tried to take a swing at him. Jerry had him on the ground and handcuffed in less than 10 seconds. Other than that, though, a town the size of Silver Bay can't afford to have round-the-clock service, so you might say I pretty much work alone. Melissa looked at her with concern. How much longer before Dan Butler returns to duty? The end of next week. Then I can take my vows and turn the case over to him. I only wish he'd been able to come back to work before this happened. I didn't need this. Melissa knew she was pushing it a little when she asked, What if the case is still active? Do you think you can walk away from it? Just watch me, Deidre answered emphatically, then downed the last swallow of Chardonnay. Melissa smiled. Then you can spend more time with Ben and his daughters. Exactly, Deidre shot back and then caught herself. Again her face turned red, and she got up, poked at the glowing embers in the stove, and added two sticks of split firewood. Melissa laughed, enjoying Deidre's discomfort. Well, I'm glad you two are just friends. Deidre sat back down on the floor cushion. Pete came over, his tail wagging, and laid his head in her lap. She scratched him behind his ears, and the lab closed his eyes in satisfaction. Soon he was wheezing as he slept. We're good friends, and I don't think it'll ever be any different. He loved his wife deeply, and I love John the same way. Right now, I think we're two injured people who need each other's company. Melissa stared at the logs that had burst into flame and said nothing. The two women sat for a half hour in silence, Deidre petting Pete's head and Melissa savoring the last of her wine. Finally, Deidre announced, I think we better turn in. Judy expects us in Two Harbors by 9 o'clock, which means we have to get up at 6:30. I'll get you a down comforter. I warn you, though, it'll be cold in here by morning. The fire will have gone out, and I'm not getting up to stoke it in the middle of the night. We can build a fire to take the chill out of the air before breakfast, which, by the way, will be pretty simple. Oatmeal, toast, and coffee. Deidre helped Melissa make up her bed, and both of them retired for the night. She thought she would fall asleep immediately after a difficult day and all the wine she'd consumed, but she was mistaken. Every time she closed her eyes, she saw the pathetic figure of the body they had removed, and she tossed and turned. Once she lifted her head and looked at the red numbers of the face on her digital bedside clock. 1 o'clock, and Deidre did the math, only 5.5 hours until the alarm would go off. When it seemed like she had just fallen asleep, she heard the buzz of her clock, soft at first but gradually increasing in volume until she couldn't stand it anymore. She reached over and shut it off, her eyes still closed, and swung her legs over the side of the bed. The cold floor jolted her, and she opened her eyes. Pete came into the room, looking at her with an urgency that said he had to go out. A cold blast of air hit her in the face when she opened the door, and she became fully awake. Deidre's head ached, from lack of sleep, she thought. Certainly it wasn't from the wine she had consumed the night before. She started a fire in the stove. By the time she had the coffee pot on the kitchen range, she could feel the heat beginning to radiate into the cabin. She heard Melissa's feet make contact with the floor. My God, is it always this cold in the morning? Deidre laughed. No, sometimes it's a lot colder. Let's fix breakfast and eat before we clean up. By then, the cabin will be warm and we'll be able to wash, brush, and flush in comfort. Melissa didn't object. Chapter 4. Neither woman said a word as they traveled down Highway 2 toward Two Harbors, each absorbed in her own thoughts. Finally, Melissa spoke. What do you think Judy is going to find when she examines the body? I can only guess, Deidre answered, shrugging. My thought is the girl was at a party and had too much to drink, or got into some bad drugs and ended up dead. At least that's what her friends may have thought. They panicked and dumped her body so they wouldn't be implicated. I suppose she might have been violated by male partygoers while she was passed out. Because she was frozen in a fetal position, it was difficult to determine the full extent of her injuries. Some of the bruises we saw might have been the result of her being thrown into a car and then off the bridge. But there are so many other possibilities. I don't know. We do have that key we found. If we can figure out what RRR stands for, it'll make our job a heck of a lot easier. I have a bad feeling about this one, Melissa said, rubbing her temples. She had gotten no more sleep than Deidre. I don't know what it is, but I can't buy into the idea that this is the result of a party gone bad. I wish I could tell you why, but I don't know. We're trained to follow the evidence and not go with our gut feelings, but right now, my guts are telling me a lot. Like what? Why wouldn't her friends help her? Deidre was silent for over a minute. I have a friend who's an EMT. He told me one time he and his partner were called to a party where someone had fallen off a balcony. When they got there, the party was still going strong, and everyone was pretty wasted. The young man who had fallen was lying on the ground, and no one was paying any attention to him. They were too busy partying to care about him. All my friend and his partner could do was load him in the ambulance and take him into the hospital. Not one of the partiers even asked how he was doing. He said when you're at one of those bashes, you have no friends. I still think we're looking at the consequences of an underage party. Yes, but in your friend's case, somebody at the party took the time to call 911, or else the EMTs would never have been alerted, right? Deidre had to agree. So if this isn't the result of a pit party gone bad, what is it? There isn't much else that goes on in this neck of the woods that would end up with a young girl naked and dead. They passed a roadside sign that read Two Harbors, population 3,750, and Deidre said, Well, we'll know more in a few minutes after we've talked to Judy. I wonder if that poor girl's body has thawed yet. Melissa, so deeply in thought that she really hadn't heard Deidre's comment, didn't answer. They pulled up behind the funeral home and walked up the steps in silence. Deidre pushed a button that rang a buzzer inside the building, and a solemn-faced funeral assistant opened the door. Hi, Deidre. Dr. Koster said you'd be getting here about now. She's downstairs, still sitting by the cooler where we hold bodies before embalming. I think she only slept in spurts last night and could probably use a fresh cup of coffee. There's some in my office if you want to take a cup to her. Deidre thanked him and filled a mug with a steaming brew. Then she and Melissa descended the stairway to the lower level where bodies were delivered into an underground garage and receiving area. Judy was seated on a stool, looking haggard and emotionally exhausted. You look worse than a mouse that's been toyed with by a cat, Melissa remarked as Judy looked up. Didn't you sleep at all last night? Not much, only a few short naps in between examinations. Because it wasn't frozen to the core, the body is almost completely thawed. I somewhat expected that, because it hadn't lain in the cold for more than several hours before being found. Deidre looked at her disheveled friend with concern. Here, we brought you a cup of fresh coffee. Take a minute to drink it before we get into the nitty-gritty of what you found. Judy sipped the hot brew and closed her eyes. She held the cup in both hands and inhaled the aroma, then took another sip. Why don't the two of you sit down? I'm afraid you're not going to like what I have to tell you. This is more than a teenager who got herself into a bad situation. Deidre and Melissa pulled up chairs and sat so the three were looking at each other. Judy took a long swig of the coffee before continuing. I'm certain that the victim was tortured before she was thrown off the bridge. Evidently, those who assaulted her thought she was dead and had no fear that she would live to ID them. She took another gulp of coffee and sighed. The others waited for her to say more, but after a few seconds, they realized she was struggling to talk. Tears formed in Judy's eyes, and she cleared her throat. There's a strange mark on one of her ankles. The skin has been rubbed raw, rubbed off, really. There are less grievous abrasions on her wrists. She has several lacerations on her extremities that could have been made by being beaten with a thin rod of some kind, some of them fresh, some of them partially healed. She took one last swig of coffee, emptying the cup. Deidre and Melissa sat in stunned silence as Judy continued. She has bruises over most of her body, and her breasts appear to have been pinched by some sort of implement, especially her nipples. Judy stopped and took a breath, unable to continue. "Do you have any idea what caused the mark on her ankle?" Deidre asked in a subdued voice. "Only one thing. She was forced to wear a shackle for an extended period of time. The marks on her wrists were from some kind of restraint, possibly plastic ties that were recently placed there. I have no doubt this girl, this child really, was held captive by being chained up. If I could get my hands on whoever did this, I'd gouge his heart out, if I could even find one." She stared at the floor, and the others waited, not knowing what to say. Judy continued, "On top of it all, the signs are pretty conclusive that she was strangled. There are marks around her throat consistent with the grip of someone much larger than she. The whites of her eyes were marked with numerous petechiae. They are areas of bleeding caused when small blood vessels rupture, a common sign of asphyxiation, or in this case, strangulation. I can't imagine what this pathetic waif suffered at the hands of an incredibly cruel person or persons." "Have you finished the examination of her body?" Deidre asked, her voice quiet as though she were in church. "No," Judy answered, "but that was what I found as of 2 hours ago. I'm guessing I can finish now." She reached for the handle of the cooler in which the body was stored. Melissa had sat silently, her eyes closed and head bowed, while Judy described her findings. She opened her eyes and looked up. Was she sexually assaulted? Judy paused before opening the door. "I couldn't tell for sure. The body needed a little more time to thaw so I could examine her genitals, but I think we can proceed now. I'm quite certain what we are going to discover, though." She opened the door and pulled a sheet-draped gurney from the cubicle. The three stood motionless, not wanting to remove the cover, but knowing they must. Judy gently folded the sheet down to the dead girl's waist, then folded the bottom up and lifted the cover off. They looked at the naked body in horror. Yesterday they had seen it curled in a fetal position, and they knew the sight wasn't going to be pretty. But neither Melissa nor Deidre were prepared for the small, broken body lying on the table before them.
You've been listening to Episode 2 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors here on Literally from the North Shore.